I think when I was in primary school, usually actually don't bring money to school. Then when I'm in school, right, I'll be tempted by like, I will be tempted by the food. Then I will always borrow, hey, can you like lend me X on my so I can buy this like curry potato or like get this laksa. I, tomorrow I return you back. And I will make sure that I borrow and I'll fulfill the obligation next day. So I find that, okay, borrowing is fine. And my parents didn't say like, don't borrow that and all that.
So you already started leveraging in primary school. Yeah?
It's a different form of leveraging.
I mean, interest,
okay, that one is no interest.
We have quite a fair bit of questions from the since the inception of our Telegram chat group. Now, I think Telegram chat group, how many people do we have inside, Grace?
800 over.
800 over, okay. And I think it's like going on fire right now because almost every day we have like tons of questions come in and our participants inside the chat group are also helping each other to answer as well as our consultants as well. So I think we're going to take this chance to consolidate all the questions that we have over the past like one over month and we'll seek to answer some of the very interesting questions right here. So who would like to go first? Maybe Yurong, Grace, you want to go first? Pick a question.
I want to talk about the harmonization.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, somebody give Yurong like a plastic bag, please.
I want to talk about the topic of harmonization because recently the first harmonization project was launched and the performance, I think, greatly exceeded a lot of people's expectations on the ground, right? So specifically, the project is Lentor Mansion. It was launched over the weekend at about the start of... the preview was launched, I believe, 1st of March. Yeah. Is it 1st or 3rd of March? Yeah, early March. And then the reception has been very, very good. So over 75% of Lentor Mansion has already been sold. This, you know, is surprising to some of the buyers because Lentor project, the entire Lentor precinct definitely is not shy of any projects, right? There have been a lot of project launches in the area. And this is actually the fifth project that is in the entire Lentor precinct. So compared to some of I would say like previous projects that were launched, the performance greatly exceeded what, like for example, for
Lentor Hill Residences, Lentoria 50%, well. Lentoria 90%.
Yeah. Okay, so it being the fifth project, coupled with the fact that it's actually the first project under the harmonization rule, is surprising to a lot of people, right? So I think in the chat group, people have also asked. So first thing is, they're asking us about, you know, what do we think about this 75% performance, which is one of the better doing new launches in the past year, as well as they're asking, you know, in terms of harmonization, will these projects be difficult to sell, right? So let's talk a little bit about this entire harmonization rule and what does it mean. So moving forward, in terms of the projects that are upcoming, what has happened is that the different government groups have actually come together to standardize in terms of the what is included within the unit square footage, the allowable, sellable part of your square footage, right? So in the past, your aircon ledges will actually be included in your sellable GFA, but then now they have been excluded. So what happens is that that actually creates this, I would say like phenomena, right? Where your PSF suddenly becomes a lot higher. Why? Because now in terms of the pricing remains the same or slightly higher, for example. But it no longer includes the square footage space for your aircon ledgers. Mm. Yeah, so aircon ledgers are excluded within this square footage that you're paying for. So naturally, if you take the quantum divided by this smaller square footage, it will appear that the PSF is higher. However, if we were to look at this from an analysis point of view, what we will understand is that actually, in terms of quantum-wise, you're actually paying the same, right? But the PSF appears to the buyer as higher. So when these units enter the resale market later on, with such a so-called high PSF and, you know, arguably smaller kind of unit sizing, will this affect pricing? Yeah. So in terms of my personal thoughts, yeah, I think that actually this will just be part of the norm moving forward, right? So it's the same as, you know, when there's different cooling measures back in the past, for example, the TDSR measures, and then units became smaller, it these kind of cooling measures and these kinds of announcements will cause a ripple effect in the market. And but in terms of buyer perception and acceptability, because all the projects moving forward will also be under this same ruling. So buyers will come to calibrate that, okay, actually this is the new PSF type of pricing. But in terms of quantum, for example, they will be able to adjust like, kind of the expectations. It is only affecting in terms of buyer psychology, but if you really deep dive into the numbers, then you will still have to make sense based on the actual quantum pricing as well as this new PSF level that we're looking at.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Grace. I think good point. What might happen is that I think this will form like a new shift in the way where how we look at sizes. For example, back in 2013, the shift happened because of the very fact that there was TDSR. Developers responded because of, I would say, the capabilities in terms of borrowing power. So back then, it was a very different kind of shift. This time around, what Grace correctly points out is that in terms of harmonization, we're going to see like a brand new shift over here. So this will be like a new shifting point 11 years later that we're going to see like further reduction in terms of the square feet sizes. So we're going to enter into a brand new era, and we can take the gauge of Lantom mentioned in terms of their sizing. For example, there are 3-bit compact, so that's about 600 plus square feet, right? Or 700
786.
So the 600 plus 786.
786, 818.
Okay, 786, 818, 3-bit compact is going to be like the brand new kind of size. Even though physically, if you enter into the space, you might not feel it because it's just a reduction of some of the extra RC ledgers and strata spaces. One more thing that I think pertaining to the performance of Lantom machine is also for the very fact that I think there's a few other combination of factors. Is firstly, I think the brand of Guaco itself in the Lantom region. Number two is that it also qualifies into 1 kilometer of the very popular school that parents are hunting for compared to some of the other projects. Mm. Thirdly, I think what they have done well is also the quantum pricing. The smaller size started from like 1.1 plus, followed by 1.4 plus, and then the compact 3-bit 1.7 plus. So I think in terms of quantum pricing, they also did it in a very right sense. Yeah. Mm. And other things to point out?
Okay, I think like two main things. One is why the project performed well, and like how do we look at harmonization per square feet, right? So we talk about harmonization per square feet first. It's like this. So I think like there was a transition last time before like the bay window and planter era. So when bay window and planters are no longer become like sellable GFA, of course we see that the sizing became smaller. So if you can find projects who are comparable in terms of similar location before and after the plant beta kind of bay window planter kind of era. Yes. So you can use Waterbank and Dakota and as well as Dakota residents, for example. So their age, location, attribute, they are all very, very close. And so what you see that actually the quantum for the 3-betas are generally the same. But of course, Dakota residences being with the bay window and planter, you see that the per square feet is much lower. And maybe at $1,700 per square feet. And then Waterbank is at $2,000 per square feet. Come back and you think of it again is that usually we do not just want to analyze purely based on a per square feet entry. The quantum price for a specific location will also determine whether there's going to be a strong exit audience, whether is it investable or not. So it's similar throughout the Lantom locale. In terms of the Lantom mansion area, what happens is that the quantum pricing is actually on par with, let's say, Lantom Hill Residences and Lantom Modern or Hillock Green that has been released. So in summary wise, that how I compare this with my clients was that like every unit we look at, not just the on paper PSF, but we look at pre-harmonization PSF. So for example, if today I'm buying a 3-beta, I will add on 60 square feet into that whatever sizing to include how it will look like if I were to compare, you know, like to like a pre-harmonization kind of project, you realize that you will probably shave off about $100 per square feet for like say a 3-beta. So in that sense, you realize that the average per square feet is actually very in line with what of the previous launches that has been done in that locale. And why did it perform well? Of course, functionally, there is the 1 kilometer school attribute over there. Secondly, it's the biggest land plot at 235,000 square footage. The next biggest land plot at Lantom is 180,000 square footage. So you actually get the best density ratio in that project. Thirdly, marketing campaign-wise done by the developers are very, very well done, where they actually have the loyalty purchase come out one day before. And so that loyalty purchase, about like 9.7% units already sold before that official balloting launch. And I think that gives a lot of confidence that, hey, you know, like in a new pre-harmonization project, this can be done as well. But when I went to the show flat, I was really amazed at how functionally they really did very well in terms of maximizing the floor plan layout. So what we saw last time is that like, some clients always ask me, hey, how come nowadays the projects don't have yard one? I say that as our lifestyle changes, right, then we do not need a yard. For example, last time we don't have a dryer. So hence we need a big enough yard space to accommodate, you know, like air dry our clothes, right? And then yard becomes now becoming like not as important as like dryer has been invented. And of course, after bay window and after all this planter, right, what happens is that yes, floor sizing is becoming smaller, but I can also share that actually floor plans are becoming more effective in that sense. And harmonization will actually make the next batch of houses even more effective as what we're seeing in terms of Lentor mentioned. Something that did very interesting over here is usually, let's say for three bedders, they will have living, dining, and then the enclosed kitchen is over here. So what Lentor mentioned, they removed the entire kitchen space and your entire living dining looks way bigger than the traditional three premium kind of layout. And the kitchen-wise, they cut it into half to have a wet area and a dry area. So the dry area, because it's an open concept, now your dining space, you can actually accommodate up to 8-seater for a like three-bedder living. It is fantastic. Even for their two-bed, two-bath, they have a very fantastic layout for wall-to-wall distance, 3 meters. I've never seen two-bedders that are in the OCR, RCR region launch the last 10 years that have a 3-meter wall-to-wall. Usually that is for like three-bedders and above. And they did that kind of like floor plan, allowing that even though on paper the floor size shrink, what the space that important, right, to be allocated such that your livable space actually expanded. So I think like that's what they did really, really well from here.
Yeah. So I think in general, actually, if we look at it, then when we understand this, right, PSF is just one of the points of consideration to be understood within the larger picture, you know. So there are many other macro or even like project specific factors or even internal space maximization. These are other factors to consider alongside the PSF. But definitely as we move forward, this PSF as a point of comparison, we will also need to understand it as whether it includes, whether it's pre or post harmonization.
And I think one last thing is what Lentor mentioned in terms of like their positioning of the stacks, right? Usually when you go and look at a site plan, it's quite clear cut on like, you know, what facing is most premium and what is like, okay, like this is the worst kind of facing. Actually, when you see Lentor mentioned, right, I was trying to do the pricing analysis before the developer gave the pricing, right? And almost every stack can be considered a premium stack, which was very interesting. It was like I had the hardest time to actually try to rank it. And eventually when I look at the pricing, I understand, yeah, okay, like in summary wise, is the further the block to block distance, whether is it outside facing, internal facing, or the landed facing, where that has the biggest, widest distance, right, is where they put it as the most premium pricing. So like that is really good in terms of the overall view for that project.
Joanne, any thoughts? Do you go to the show flat?
Yeah, I was at the show flat yesterday.
Actually. Oh, how was it?
So I think in terms of the product attribute for the condo itself, there's also a very unique positioning that's done by Goku Land, which is the fact that Lentor mentioned is also one of the more luxury collection. I mean, if you look at all the other projects and portfolios so far, Midtown Modern, Midtown Mansion, Mayor Mansion, all these are so-called their luxury collection. But this is also the first time you see a mansion series coming into the OCR area. Previously, it was all RCR kind of a profile location as well. So I think that's one. The second thing in terms of optimization of floor plan, riding on to what Yurong mentioned, while it is optimized, I think they still take into consideration to give buyers a lot of flexibility. For instance, in the kitchen area for the two-bedder kind of layout, although it is open kitchen, but they made it in a way it's L-shaped. So if the buyer chooses to want to enclose, you can still do it up easily versus a sort of a single galley kind of kitchen. So a lot of these small little thoughts and details, I think, are very nicely done up within the whole project design. Some other sort of condo-wise, project-wise factors will be in terms of the facilities, the landscaping. They also gave it that ratio, 70-30 or 80-20, to give it sort of a niche, because this is also something we noticed in terms of the resale market. A lot of buyers, when they go on to the project to view for all the newly TOP project, the first impression of the condo itself, how the grounds are being done up, how the compound is being spread. This also gives the buyers that wow factor and at least a very good first impression. So I think this some different considerations and sort of feedback that we have from buyers.
What do your buyer buy?
Not bought yet, need to decouple.
Okay. Why do you think, Joanne, that actually I think Guaco is extremely smart in the sense that this is the first project in Lentor with harmonization. They are really like putting in like all the like extreme positive USP and attributes in the project. Why do you think there's no one beta?
Okay. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is also because of the one of the very strong anchor point being that it's one click within the school. So typically, one click within the popular school in the area, they would also expect the buyer audience who's keen on this project to be more family profile. Of course, you will still attract investor profile coming in, but in terms of the relative proportion, I think more families will be looking into this area as well. Also, usually we notice for condos that are really right smack, either on top of the MRT or really being situated right next to it, then you do see a higher presence of one bidder as well. For Lentor mansion, while it is still within walking distance, I think 6 to 7 minutes from the side gate, it is still one of the furthest one away. And to really fight in with the one bidders, I think buyers will have a lot of competition in terms of exit as well. That's why I think for them, they do choose to sort of give them a differentiation point as well and target the 2 to 5 bidders.
Right. Thanks. What do you guys think that there's a one bidder?
No, they are very smart though, in the sense that they actually the 2-bed, 1-bath in the almost like a 1-bedder kind of square footage. So I think like there is flexibility, right? So
I think it's done on purpose. Yeah. That means it's really like a marketing factor in the sense that like when people come, they will be like, wow, okay, instead of like a 500 plus square feet, usually I can only buy a 1 plus study. Now I can get a 2-bed, 1-bath at 1.1 plus million.
They're basically clearing off all the 1-bedders.
Then it's like immediately I'll just take it already. Mm. Yeah. So it's like a no-brainer. So I think it's an extremely smart positioning. Why there's no 1-bedder and the 2-bedder is really as good as the 1-plus study, right? So maybe moving on to this point. This has been one of the hottest topic, I think, over the last 6 months, especially since the Fed interest has been increasing. Anyway, I don't know whether have you seen the latest so-called like Fed hearing by Jerome Powell. That was, I think, about 11 days ago. It was like a 2-hour thing on Yahoo Finance. You can go to YouTube and see. So he sort of hinted that if really they can keep the inflation rate on target to be around 2%, there's really a high chance second quarter or third quarter of this year, they will start to taper down on the rates already. So this has been a hot topic in terms of, should you pay down a mortgage or leverage? What do you guys think? Maybe Grace, what do you think? Will you ever pay down a mortgage for your own house? Let's say suddenly your outstanding loan is like X amount and then suddenly your bank have this amount. Will you like one shot pay it down for usually people pay down because of
peace of mind.
Yeah, certainty, right? Yeah. What do you think?
I will not. Yeah, personally, I will not pay down my mortgage even if I strike Toto, which I'm still banking on. Yeah, but personally, I will not because I mean, we always understand that you know, actually, there's a difference between good debt and bad debt, right? So in terms of real estate, we always have this term in PRB that we say is real estate eats inflation for breakfast, right? So I mean, it's really about personal preferences and also what do you think that the runway for your money, like, let's say if you were to keep it, you pay off your mortgage because you do not want that burden of that monthly mortgage and also in terms of interest rates, you do not want to pay that interest, right? Versus let's say if you think that your money can be, you know, can generate better returns somewhere else. Yeah. So a few different, I think, concepts at play. But my main rationale if I were to choose not to pay down my mortgage, I think basically it would be the main idea is that I'm borrowing other people's money to pay for the 75%. So I only need 25%. I can leverage this 75%, right? So to me, it's a leverage game. If let's say I really were to have this additional money, right? Actually, in fact, I will go and invest in one more property. Yeah. And then I will continue the leverage factor. And then I will continue to borrow so that I can own multiple assets at the end of the day instead of paying off one. Yeah.
Right. So you will never pay off your mortgage. You just keep holding it.
I will never pay it off.
Okay, great. Yu-Rong, how about yourself? Will you ever pay off?
Investment property, the answer is almost 100% no, because your interest is taken care of by the tenant. So basically, you are running an investment with no cost. So there's no point paying down. And when you leverage, actually, you, on simple terms, you already 4x your money. When this is a pure investment where I rent out the property, so the answer is no. When I pay down, basically my returns will drop significantly. If it's for own stay property, I will only pay down if, let's say, my net worth to that loan ratio is at least 5 to 10x of that. Then, okay, then I'll pay down. If not, I think I will still be in a position where when I take this loan for the property loan, right, I have other means in property or in other asset classes that I can easily make back this 3-4% of interest that I'm incurring. So to me, it wouldn't make sense to pay down.
Joanne?
For me,
Do you pay down your house? You pay off, right?
He's a baller. La. Full cash.
Me.
Oh, okay. I always think that you are a very like safe person.
No, she's just rich. She's not safe.
Are you a risk averse person? Do you take risks?
In certain aspects. Yes.
Like what?
She buy REITs.
Certain allocation buy of REITs, my portfolio.
She only owns Singapore stocks. She don't own US stocks.
Certain allocation of my portfolio then, yes. A bit more on the riskier side, but then...
It's been like donkey ages since I heard people invest in Singapore stocks already. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to get cancelled.
Hey, sorry. Okay, come, continue.
So I think for me, the way I approach it is if I decide not to pay off, then what else will I be doing with this money?
Mm.
If this money is just sitting in a bank account and it has very, very low yield, and if it makes sense for me to pay off, then maybe I would. But if, let's say, hypothetically, the current package that I'm on for the mortgage is like 1%, and if that's so low, I'd rather just take the cash and go and invest in other higher yield products and then just incur that 1%, because net-net, I'm still in a more beneficial position. That's what I would do. But in a reverse scenario, if let's say the mortgage interests are like super high and it doesn't make sense for me to be incurring that kind of interest, then I would rather just pay off and not be incurring that high sort of costing for me. But the second thing, that's on the cost side. The second thing is also, I think fundamentally as an investment product, I think property is also one of those that you can leverage. You can't leverage if, say, you're going into other financial assets. Typically, the bank won't loan you, like what Grace mentioned, good debt versus bad debt. And this is probably one of the only products where you can take a leverage, like what we all mentioned, 25%, 75% you're using other people's money. And in that kind of perspective, then I think the cash on cash, it makes sense for me to continue holding if my mortgage interest that I'm incurring right now is not at a high premium.
I think another consideration, very simple, is if, for example, you are very confident that if you are incurring 3% interest on your mortgage loan and you can easily make 9% on return on money, then that is very clear cut. At least 3 times, right? Then that's very clear cut. You shouldn't be paying down. Yep. But if anything lesser than 9%, of course, you know, like, market uncertainty, you might not be able to hit, and you're a very, very safe person, then of course you can pay down. As long as your income is there, you can always do a gearing reverse mortgage, and then you can take out that liquidity again, assuming this is a private property, and you will be able to do other investment later down the road when you have better knowledge or better skill set. But if it's a HDB, then 100% try not to pay down first and go and learn how to invest in other areas, because it's a one-way street. You cannot reverse this entire scenario. And I would say mortgage interest is what we call like reducing interest, right? So it's one of those things that like your interest gets lesser and lesser every single month as the outstanding loan drops, versus other types of loans like your fixed your car loan and all that stuff. You're always based on the first original loan amount. So if you want to pay down any loan, go pay down your higher interest loan first. Then you come back to the property loan.
Anyway, when do you all think the interest rate will start to come down? I mean, like in Singapore now, for resale and new launch, like what are the rates now? Maybe share with our clients.
In Singapore, that will be next year, long. Okay, so now fixed rate is at 3%. Floating rate, 3 months SORA is at 3.6+. So, if you are on a floating rate 3 months SORA, you are probably at a 4.1% interest rate, lah. Assuming that you are now entering into the rate, I have saw people whose rates is at 5%. Because yeah. They are, like, they finished their package.
Mine is 4.9. Huh? I don't know.
Your mortgage rate is 4.9.
Yeah,
like bank loan.
4.85 or something.
Yeah, if you are on a resale property, you shouldn't be
refinance lah.
I haven't crossed the 1. Did I cross the 1 year mark?
That's repriced. Don't need to refinance. I think a lot of people have.
Still under lock-in.
No, a lot of people have the misconception of like.
Sorry, continue.
So I think like if you are on a resale property, then you should be on a fixed rate. That's one. Floating rate is, unless you know like you are on a package that you have some form of combination and flexibility that you can sort of like switch anytime. But generally wise is that like, I will see that this year, we will start to see rate cuts. Sorry, eating a lot of food. Rate cuts from the Fed Central Bank, maybe in the third quarter, fourth quarter. And so I think in terms of like how it will impact Singapore, floating rate, probably you will see in first quarter or second quarter next year, you will start to see things start to taper down.
Joanne, we talk about this a lot of time, right? What do you think will happen when interest rates start to come down?
Bitcoin goes up.
I'm going to go into that topic. I think in general, because interest is also the cost of borrowing. When the cost of borrowing drops, in general, your financial affordability or purchasing power of the layman will then be a little bit higher. Then that's when I think a lot of buyers will then come into the market. And I think what we are sort of not afraid of, just don't want it to happen, is the whole FOMO effect taking place and chasing a new pricing benchmark. Because if that's the case, then a lot of buyers might be priced out if they choose to wait longer. Yeah.
Right. Thanks. I think the fundamental thing about mortgage and loans is that money is like a form of energy. So, for example, if you need to buy a house for your family and you want to wait until you really save up the entire amount of like $1 million, or maybe if it's a HDB flat, $500,000. If you really want to save up that full amount, by the time your life is already over, technically speaking, like you probably would take 10 years to save that amount, and you need to have that discipline to save that amount and not touch the money. So when you loan and you mortgage, is technically borrowing the energy from the bank so that you can own it now while you focus on other things. Similarly, let's say if you are in a job that needs a vehicle, but you tell yourself that, hey, let me save up for 10 years before I buy that vehicle. By the time 10 years later, firstly, the vehicle will have risen in price due to inflation. Secondly, is that you already lost the opportunity to make more money over the last 10 years because you couldn't use the energy to buy more time to do other things. So I think when we look at mortgage, loans, debts, it really depends on whether are you exchanging the energy for more time and more opportunity. So that's the first level to look at it. Second thing is that we are in a debt-based economy. So what do I mean by a debt-based economy is that because of fractional reserve banking, banks have like a 5 to 10x power depending on which country you are in. So if you are a bank, in most countries, you only need to have $1 in order to be eligible to loan out $5 or $10. So because of that fact, this fractional reserve banking system really benefits people who take debt. And if you do not partake in debt, you're losing out in the sense that averagely, if you look at the book Bitcoin Standard by Professor Saifedean Amos, he calculated that across all countries in the world, averagely your money in the bank depreciates by 7% per annum, all the way to about 17% per annum. So if you leave your cash in the bank, technically speaking, you are allowing it to be depreciated because of fractional reserve banking system. So as more money is created through loans, your money in the bank is shrinking, and you will only feel it when you are using that money to buy things, like you are using it to buy assets, like houses, properties. Then you'll feel that, hey, why is it that every year price of property keep increasing? Actually, the real underlying reason is that it's not that the price of houses keep increasing. It's just that the money keeps inflating. So because as money is inflated, more action is created by human beings to auto-divest this amount into assets that are immovable, that are more stable, and thus it inflates the price of all these assets. So actually, I think one of the very scary things that might happen is that if you look at all the tech stocks right now, they have sort of like recovered and they have appreciated. Recently, of course, Bitcoin has already surpassed total market capitalization of silver. Silver has a history of like decades in the entire history of human civilization, but Bitcoin, within the past 1 month, has already surpassed the total market cap of silver and is now going to challenge like Google, and eventually it will challenge gold in terms of the amount of market cap. So for example, this kind of search, this was because of the fact that all the major hedge funds and players like BlackRock, Fidelity Investment, they are being approved by SEC for the exchange traded fund. And of course, in the last 1 month, you see Bitcoin rise from 40,000 all the way to 73,000. Now it dipped back to a bit of 68,000 because there's this thing called the pre-halving retracement and stuff like that. But what is going to happen is that if it continues to go up in terms of its value, which I personally think it will, some retail investors are going to cash up. And what they're going to do is that they're going to take a safety position. And what would they do naturally is that they'll either hold it in cash or they'll start to put it into real estate. And when that happens, then it will further inflate the price of real estate. So as we move to this topic about real estate versus crypto, I mean, I think there's a lot of people asking us in our Telegram chat group, right? Like, what should you do? And of course, some of the questions are very direct. Should you sell your property and buy crypto, which I think is like a very dangerous question, because we don't want, we have to really put in a huge disclaimer here when it comes to this kind of financial advice. And I think maybe we can just share from our personal opinion. I mean, I personally myself, I've already studied, I read like a lot of books on Bitcoin all the way from 2020 until today. I use a dollar cost averaging approach. I believe in Bitcoin. I think you can refer to a previous episode. I actually talked about it when it was like $20,000+. But what do you guys think? I mean, in terms of real estate and crypto, maybe you can share a little bit. Grace, what do you think?
I think just a small like comment, you know, when you were sharing about us being in a debt economy, it made me think about, you know, when you are young and you're growing up, and then you always have this concept that debt is bad. That you should never, you know, owe money. You should never leverage, you should not owe anybody any money. Like that's the traditional fundamental concept. I think a lot of children grow up hearing maybe, but you know, understanding that we are in a debt economy, right? Is that if you do not leverage on good debt, if you do not put your money in an asset, right, that can bring you further than what you currently have, then actually you are on a losing position. That's something that we don't think about, right? We always think about, okay, debt is always like bad, you know, debt is always bad. Definitely there's bad debt as well. But when we talk about the concept of good debt, it's basically leveraging on the money to buy into assets that can bring you it can grow your money further and faster than if you were to leave it in the bank. I think that's how we understand it. So, it did strike me, because I think like growing up that there's that concept, right? And then slowly as you learn, you read and all that, you watch YouTube videos, then you start to realize that, oh, actually not all debt is bad. Yeah.
I got one point to touch on. Then I want to ask Grace back a question, is that I need to put in the fact that because we're in a debt economy, so leveraging on good debt is very important. However, there's two things that we need to take note of, is that the moment you cannot fulfill your debt obligation on a monthly basis, your collateral will be confiscated. Mm. So your car can be so-called towed away by the bank. Your property can be seized if you cannot pay the installment for 3 months. So it being a debt economy, the disadvantage is that it created more anxiousness in human beings. It created this level of like anxiousness and anxiety, in the sense that, you know, we got different kind of good and bad debt obligations to pay on a monthly basis. And thus, the behavior of human beings is very different compared to before 1971, where there was a gold standard.
Before the gold standard was removed. Like.
Yeah, so that means like, last time, if you leave your money in the bank, your money will be more powerful. You will find that things will get cheaper. Cars will get cheaper, houses will get cheaper, because your money appreciated. But now, what is happening is that things that are getting cheaper are things like, for example, clothes, iPhone cable, like, you know, like cloths, things like that.
Consumer products are getting cheaper.
Where there's mass production. But things that are extremely important, your home, your cars, and things like that, it doesn't get cheaper. It gets more expensive. So let me come back to Grace. Is that, why do you think that, you know, like maybe living in Singapore, because I also have this concept when I was young, is that I'm actually very afraid of money. And then maybe growing up, people around me or my parents or relatives say, oh, 不要借钱啊. Like, you know, 钱很难赚啊. So, you know, the common language is like, money is like very hard to earn. And, you know, like, you got to be really, really careful. You tend to have like cautious approach. Why do you think some of these languages maybe has wired us in a different way?
I don't have this wiring.
What was your wiring?
I never thought like that was bad.
Okay.
Because I think like two things. Number one was, I think when I was in primary school, usually I don't have a lot of pocket money. So I actually don't bring money to school. Then when I'm in school, right, I will be tempted by the food. Right. And I don't have any money. Right? Then I will always borrow, hey, can you like lend me X amount of money so I can buy this like curry potato or like get this laksa? I said, tomorrow I'll return you back. And I will make sure that I borrow and I fulfill the obligation next day. So I find that, okay, borrowing is fine. And my parents didn't say like, don't borrow that and all that.
So you really started leveraging in primary school. Yeah.
It's a different form of leveraging.
Got interest.
Okay, that one is no interest.
Ever forget to pay somebody off?
No.
You can tell it on national TV now.
No. Only people forget to pay me off. But okay. I always pay people off, right? So So I didn't have this. And I find that it's okay, you know, like, so like you can think of my friend as like the banker, and you know, I'm the retail client, but I don't pay interest. So I also think that, okay, number one, I think I was exposed to this book called Rich Dad Poor Dad very, very early, where I understand the concept of money, I mean, a little bit better. good debt, bad debt. Then I just feel like, okay, debts are actually okay. As long as I know that it's like a business, right? I incur X number of interest. As long as I'm able to generate more revenue to cover back the interest. I mean, that's how the entire business system works. If you see like all the Google, Apple and all that, of course, some of these major companies might be debt free, but a lot of time they have maybe the same amount of debt versus the amount of cash that they have. And why do they still leverage, right? So I don't have this concept, which I find that is quite good.
Okay.
Yeah. But I lost a lot of money also on like other...
I thought you were going to say I lost a lot of friends.
No. I lost a lot of money on like all the bad investments when I was much younger. And hence, I had a more discerning mindset when it comes to number one, who do I seek professional advice with? How do I give out professional advice? It's part of my interest to be very analytical and think about where do I gather the sources to determine where should I be putting my money. Because everybody was just trying to sell me a product.
What were the bad investments?
Age 19, I lost a Ponzi scheme. I actually convinced my parents to take out their retirement money to put in this Ponzi scheme. And my dad actually said this to me. He said, this one is confirmed a Ponzi scheme. He told me that. And then as somebody that is very gullible at the point of time, at the age, right? Not much life experience. I said, no, this is very good. 10x. And I believe in that 10x that can happen in like a 3 to 4 years time. And so my dad actually said, okay, never mind. You take this. This will be your educational fee. Oh, he said you will lose it one.
So good, all your dad.
He said you will lose it. And you want to know that we are from a very average family. Wow. And he happened to be at age 55. And this one, he was drawing out his retirement funds.
My God.
And he said, like, this is your tuition fee. And I took the money. I said, like, I will prove you wrong.
Oh my God.
And actually, in the first 6 months, right, I managed to actually 3x the money. By the next 6 months, I lost everything. Yeah.
What was the conversation with your dad?
The conversation, he was very chill about it. He said, like, I really expected it to happen. Wow. I felt guilty, obviously. But it gave me a very strong lesson that, okay, like financial products, anything that is money related, I'm going to make sure I'm very savvy such that like this thing do not happen again. I'm not going to take any Tom, Dick, Harry advice on anything from insurance policy all the way until investment products. I will do my own research to make sure that I understand prioritization, asset allocation, risk versus reward, and then I will do my execution.
So your dad just wanted to love you to give you a...
No, like, I mean, I was trying to...
You already
to,
know it will happen.
Yeah, he knows that it will happen. And I thought like, okay, yeah.
Wow.
So what is it that this time you believe in me and you went to buy Bitcoin?
No, like, don't anyhow say I believe in you. This is a...
What do you buy?
Huh? I did buy Bitcoin also.
Why?
Okay. Initially, I already started my crypto allocation like, I think 2 years back. But I hit a setback, which was when FTX closed down when I was having COVID. I was not monitoring. And FTX closed down. I was like, okay. Like, I believe in crypto, but I was taken aback in the sense like, I did not envision or foresee like, the intermediary is the second largest will actually close down. Yeah.
It's an exchange. Yeah.
And it was because actually, Melvin was asking me to use... What's that?
No, la,
like an exchange. I'm not talking about the company, right? And then the exchange that introduced me, right? Because the transaction fee, right, was very high. Then I thought I was like trying to be a smart aleck. Then I switched.
So that time I told you already.
You already told me to use
the trusted one.
The local one. So I was like, okay. Yeah. Like, it is so big. I mean, like the second biggest. And then I save a lot on transaction fees. Then it's okay. Then I'll just kickstart. Oh. But of course, that time, at least I allocated in a percentage that like even if I lose everything, I won't feel like, you know, like I cannot survive.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is that so there's a difference between the commodity versus the exchange that is helping you to trade the commodity. So the commodity itself is sound. So Bitcoin is a technology, it's a money technology, it is sound. Anyway, now Bitcoin is already classified not as a security already, it's really classified as an asset, as a commodity, just like gold and silver. It's not owned by anybody. There's no CEO, there's no co-founder, there's no nothing. The person who wrote the code already gave out the entire code to the peer-to-peer network. So anybody that now owns Bitcoin owns the code. So basically, nobody can increase the supply anymore. Nobody can do anything with it. But anyway, coming back to the exchange, I want to tell you one more thing is that exchange, no matter how certified or how regulated they are, there's still a certain amount of risk. So it is still better to put in a hard wallet. Yeah. So for example, go for hard wallet that you can store. But of course, hard wallet, you don't lose it. Like once you lose it, it's gone already. So there's still one.
Hard wallet, you lose it, it'll be hard pin.
Hard wallet is the most important thing when you want to store Bitcoin or other form of cryptocurrency. Mm. Okay, so...
you store it in hard wallet?
Yes, I store in hard wallet. I saw a huge proportion in the hard wallet and then I have a liquidity pool inside the exchange. So that I can trade.
Where is the hard wallet?
I use Ledger Life. Yeah. But anyway, they never
Where specifically in your house?
It's in somewhere. Yeah, it's in somewhere. So you should never reveal location of hard wallet or the code, lah, all right?
Maybe you can send it to us after this.
Can put it in your handbag, right? Okay. Joanne, what about yourself? What do you think? This topic, real estate versus crypto. Because of people ask us, should I sell my real estate and put everything into Bitcoin?
No. I think the question wasn't whether he should.
But anyway, I already answered in our Telegram chat group. Anyway, if you join our Telegram chat group, just scroll up, look for Melvin's reply. I already attached my reply already. Okay.
Add the QR code here to join us.
Yeah, join us in our Telegram chat group.
I think it doesn't need to be a versus. I think it can be an and. But I think more importantly, whether it's crypto or any other financial asset, my personal approach is to do enough homework and be clear of what I'm entering into before I go on and buy, and not just chase the trend or chase, because everybody's buying, everybody's making money, and then I just go in and buy hastily. Just like property, just like any other financial assets.
You need to analyze and study.
Yeah, you need to know what you're getting yourself into. And you need, if this is like one of your more riskier allocation, then you need to be prepared that if I were to, let's say, risk and lose this sum of money, I can still lead my life for the next, say, 1 year, 2 years, and then I find other ways to recoup back. I think that is, for me, how I approach it. It can be crypto, it can be any other financial asset, but I think it's to educate yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So actually, really don't listen to us or don't listen to anybody else that if you ask them, hey, should I buy this or buy that? Because I think end of day, investing has risks, and you will only be certain on your investment if you do enough analysis and education. So you are certain of the asset that you are investing in. Just like real estate, if you know the fundamentals in terms of the way that we look at mood analysis, the rationale and the frameworks, then you'll be very certain that you're buying into this property in the sense that you are certain of its performance. You will not fire sale whenever there's like a trigger event that's happening. So for example, if let's say, I mean, I just had a friend 2 weeks ago ask me, hey, should I buy Bitcoin or not? Then I said, no. The friend asked me, should I sell my Bitcoin? Because it went up to like 68,000 or 70,000. I said, don't sell. And I said, I've already done my homework. I'm very confident of a certain price that will happen after the halving, which is like 500 days after halving. Halving is happening on like mid of April. But if you are always not sure in terms of like understanding the underlying fundamental performance and what is this about, what is this technology about, then you will keep looking at the price every day and you will find that it's very anxious. So for me, I treat it like I treat this like a bank account in the sense that it is like a dollar cost averaging. I'm certain of its performance. To me, it's an apex kind of asset class. It's quite similar to like landed property in Singapore, where it's an apex property in Singapore. The supply cannot be increased anymore. When price increase, supply cannot flood in to bring down the price performance. So to me, I've already done my homework. But what about yourself? If you have not done your homework, read up first before you go to purchase a single dollar of it. So I think education is extremely important.
Why do I go and gamble? Let's say I have no money. I have X amount of dollars. I want to go to the casino to try my luck.
Yeah. I don't think it's not possible.
No, I say it can be achievable. I never say it cannot be achievable.
My list will intersect. Okay. I do not think that it will be like completely separate.
Okay, sure. Yeah. I will just continue my side. Okay.
It's a discipline, right? It keeps ourselves accountable that, if I don't make this happen, I don't have a place to sleep. My kids will need to move out.